my first time out in Colorado, and so far I've got a pretty good impression of y'all. I hope you get a good impression of me. We are here this weekend to talk about a most serious set of topics, and that is the strongholds that Satan gets in our lives and how these strongholds become major fortresses for the devil to camp out and consume the rest of our lives. We're going to be talking about that this weekend. I'm going to get used to you for just a second here, and you get used to me, and then we're going to nail this topic. So by profession, I preached the gospel full-time for about 17 years, and at some point in time, I junctured and moved into the mental health and addiction business as well, and I still preach up in Plymouth, Indiana, although I live about 2.5 hours from there. I go up every Saturday and Sunday and conduct home studies and preach with the brethren there in Plymouth, Indiana. I helped start that congregation when I lived in that town. And they wouldn't let me go, so I have to drive now. But in my secular life, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm a licensed certified addiction counselor. I have an international certification in addictions counseling. A whole bunch of letters after my name, and they don't mean anything except I pass some tests and I have to write those down as part of having the paper on my wall. But in my day job, I work with homeless people in Indianapolis. We have the property I work for has 586 apartment units, and we house only formerly homeless people. And so we bring them in from the street, and of course that brings in that plethora of situations that are on those streets. In the other part of my life, I am a family addictions counselor up at a long-term men's rehabilitation center for alcohol and drugs, and there I serve the rich and the famous, literally the rich and the famous, and their families. And what I note between all of those, whether it's on the streets or whether it is up in the elite section of town, the characteristics of addiction remain just about the same. And we're going to talk about how addictions have patterns to them and how those patterns are portrayed in various families and individuals. So we'll talk some about that. In addition to that, I also work in mental health, and so I have been up and down the food chain from the line to an executive office, and I've worked in those arenas working with mental health and addiction issues. And then on top of that, I do this series and have done this at several places by invitation of brethren for several years. And as I've gone around the country and talked to our brethren, I am majorly alarmed at an epidemic that is going on amongst our people who are calling themselves children of God. What we are seeing is about 1 in 5 families are affected by the issues of mental health and addiction, especially the addiction issues. And that's what kind of fostered this entire topic. We see people who are suffering in secret, not knowing sometimes where to turn, or ashamed to turn, or afraid that if they turn, they'll be turned on by those that they're seeking to help, find help from. And so this weekend, we're going to get to know each other tonight in terms of this introduction to addiction lesson. But what I want us to do as we dig down into the topics in the next couple of days, I want you all to feel very free to ask me questions. If you want to pull me aside and talk with me, that'll be totally fine with me. All I ask is that I have 8 hours a night to sleep, and the rest really doesn't matter because I know you eat too, and I can eat with you while we talk. But I'm here to be used, and the one thing I do not like is to come a long distance and sit. I don't like to sit. So, well, sometimes I like to sit, but most of the time I don't. So you'd be my friend if you have questions, you want to talk with me. Sometimes people want to talk privately. And usually along about the second day, folks figure out whether they can trust me or not, and a whole bunch of conversation happens. So I want you to feel free to do that. And use me however you can while I'm here, and I'll be of whatever service I can be and share whatever knowledge or expertise I can. In this series of lessons, what I will do is I will be talking from a Bible base, but I will also be bringing in some of the things, the detail of the other part of my life that hopefully will help to make some of the things we'll say clearer in terms of the addiction. This is not a series of mental health lectures without any Bible in them. This is gospel first and foremost, and that's what we want to talk about this evening. So I invite you to get your Bibles out. If you want a copy of these PowerPoints, if you'd like to receive those, we can make those available to you. There's no secrets here. All I would ask is that if you use them, do more than just change my name on them. Make them yours and use them however you want to. In the outline or in the charts on the board, I want to notice first that the word addictions is not in your Bible. That is a relatively new term in the English language, but long before there was such a thing as the word addictions, that whole concept of addictions is found in God's Word. And in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12, Paul talks about how we can become enslaved, and he says, "I will not be brought under the power of any." I'm going to look at that verse many times this week, but I want to look at that piece right now. When Paul says, "I won't be brought under the power of any," he's telling us that there are things, he talks about meat for the belly and so on and so forth, and what he says is you won't be brought under the power. That tells me that things can gain a mastery over us. Things can gain power over us. We can surrender our personal power, and we can surrender that to a power that overtakes us. And here Paul says that he is determined that whatever those subtle forces are that tend to enslave and overpower, that Paul says he would not allow himself to be brought under that kind of thing. So the word power here is one of our terms that really is an addiction kind of a word. I'll define addiction in just a moment. In the second place, Paul talks about how Satan builds strongholds, and how that the Word of God is powerful to the putting down of strongholds and everything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4, he talks about how things can have a stronghold in our life. And here's what a stronghold is. A stronghold is a fortress. It is that area of our life that Satan can gain foothold in, and there he sets up camp, and little by little he begins from there to erode everything that is precious in our life. That has to do with addictions as one of the pieces comes in there. That Satan comes into our life in a subtle way, and little by little he sets up a fortress. Now here's what I've learned too. That God also, that while Satan tries to set up camp in our lives, that God also works for us. And so in the book of Job, the first chapter, as God and Job are talking, God asks Job, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in all the earth? And Satan's response is, well, of course, sure, because you've built hedges around him. Here's my point. That if we will surrender our life to God, if we put God first and foremost in our lives, and we have a full surrender to Him, then He can build hedges around us where Satan says, I can't get to them. You've got so many things around them, I can't get through. And on the other hand, conversely, if we yield our life to Satan and we say, Lord, I'm going to surrender to you. I will do everything you ask me, except. It's that one place where we say, except, I'm not willing to go this far. That's where Satan starts and builds the fortress. It comes in a very subtle way, but it does come. And my question for you as we enter this series and as we unfold this for the next few days, does Satan have a stronghold or a fortress in your life? Is he out here attacking you in such a way that he's got you? And all he has to do is just expand the boundaries because the stronghold is going to be there. So does Satan have you? If he does, we're going to talk about how you can surrender your life and kick Satan out of your life. In the book of Daniel, the first chapter, in verse 8 and 9, here we find that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego have been taken as slaves, and they are down in a foreign country, and they've been basically pulled out, and their job is going to be to learn the language of the invading country and to teach that to their people. There's some other things in there. But in that chapter, there's an interesting concept. And that is that Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel were challenged. They were brought before, cleaned up and brought before the king into the courthouse or into the magistrate there. And there they were supposed to eat the king's dainties. Now that word dainties is the word herbs. And I'm not quite sure from the context all that's involved there, whether those herbs were anything near drugs or whether it was just some fancy food. I'm not sure. But here's what I am sure of, that whatever it was, that Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego took a stand. And that stand ended them up basically standing against the king and saying, no, we're not going to eat the king's dainties. And what that meant is that they stood alone. They stood and they said no, even though the powers around them were threatening powers. And what I want to suggest to you is that God's children need to be able to stand up, not be afraid or fearful of anyone, a king or anyone else. And when we have to make a decision that is God's decision for God, we ought not to be ashamed, and we ought not to hedge on that. We ought to stand up and say, no, we're not going to do that. They did the same thing with the fire furnace later on, and they took their stand. And there they said, oh, great king, we will not bow down before this image. And they were thrown into the fiery furnace as a result of that, but they came out triumphant. Here's what I want you to see, is that when you take your stand for God, God will reward you. When you allow Satan to come into your life in any form, and he begins to set up a camp in your life, then Satan will overpower you. God rewards you, Satan overpowers you. And that's the premise we're going to work on during this weekend. And so as we look at this lesson, I want you to look at a couple of approaches. There are two areas we're going to look at this weekend. The first is, if you are a Christian, if you're one that maybe would say that I've been raised in the church, I'm one of those. The question for us is how to keep us from looking over the fence into the world and saying, man, I wonder what I missed. You know, here I am, I've been brought up in church all my life, and I know how to be a Christian, but I just feel like I'm missing out on something over there. And so the question is, how can Christians keep from getting in that mindset, thinking that the world is greater out there? I work out in the midst of a lot of this mess. And I want to tell you, the people that are out there want to be where you are. And we ought not to want to be where they are. Because many folks have messed up and destroyed their life, have so much baggage that it's going to take years to untangle some of the things because Satan has a stronghold in their lives. Well, the two approaches we're going to use is, first, we need to figure out how to keep ourselves unspotted from the world, to where we are convinced that serving God is not just something we ought to do, it is the very best thing for us to do, that God has given us instructions that are intended for our good, to keep us out of trouble, to keep us in a good life, and to be able to reward us finally with that reward in heaven. And the second thing we want to look at in this is, and maybe this more so, is that as the gospel is like the great dragnet, the New Testament, Jesus talked about that in Matthew, the kingdom of God being like a dragnet, we issue the call to come. Jesus says, come. Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. And when Jesus says, come, guess what? People come. When we, and we'll talk more about that on Sunday, but when the messages come, people come. But when they come with baggage. When people come out of the world, and people come with backgrounds, they come out of the bars, they come out of the street corners, they come out of jails and prisons. They come. When Jesus says, come, people come. And we need to ask the question, how are we going to deal with the influx of people who are coming from the world and help them to be bolstered without them spotting us or without being spotted or influenced by negative things that might come with them? And so we have a real challenge in the church. While we're trying to help others, we also need to realize that we could fall. And this is the great challenge before us. Staying strong and helping those who come in to learn the way of truth and to grow and develop and to feel welcomed. That whatever is going on with them, that we are here as a resource, as someone to strengthen them. Joshua was a young man I worked with, and this is a statement that he made. He told me one day, he said, Art, I didn't start out thinking I'd ever be here. I had a grape swisher, a bag, a pipe, and a syringe, and I just went out to have a good time. But I didn't come back. I didn't come back because I couldn't find the path. I was on the end of a pipe all along thinking, someday, it'll be different. But not today. That's the story of an addict. A person who went out to have what he thought was a good time and couldn't find his way back. And addiction grabs hold of us. And so with that in mind, what I must loudly say is anybody that's playing with addiction needs to understand the thing they are playing with is not playing with them. Satan will not be satisfied until he has everything you have and everything you are. I meet week after week and day after day with groups of addicted people. And what I hear them say over and over again is that this life of addiction it meant everything to me. It meant more than my family. It meant more than my money. It meant more than my job. It meant more than even my own life because I put my life at risk. Talked to a man the other day that said, I couldn't tell you how many times I've had a gun put up to my head when I was trying to cut my deal. And I asked him, did you go back? And he said, you know I did. Because this had a hold on his life. Addiction is not satisfied until the person is dead. It will rob you of everything you have. Now let's talk just a moment about what addiction is. I am talking in this lesson, this series of lessons, about that which starts out small in our life. And as 2 Timothy 3:13 says, evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. And what we're talking about here is something that starts out small, that seems innocent. Maybe we'll be riding along in a car and with some of our friends, maybe we're a young person, we're riding along and someone takes a toke, takes a little funny cigarette out and takes a drag off of it and hands it and it passes around the car and you have a choice right there before you and you have a temptation before you. As you ride along, am I going to join the world? Am I going to indulge in this? Or am I going to be a child of God and do the right thing? What is the right thing? And those choices you need to make before you get in the car. But if you don't make them before, you need to make them in the car. And that can happen little by little. Then this thing gets a hold in your life. And little by little, it begins to consume until finally your whole life is eroded. The relationship is with the chemical. And that chemical will destroy you or can destroy you. In this lesson, we're talking about the chemical. Can destroy you internally, externally, and eternally. It can wipe your life out. Now, I want to suggest to you that substances are being used in order to give people experiences that only Jesus can really give you. substances are often used as a spiritual experience. And I hear people say it like this, well, you know, I just need to, my mind's so, I'm so messed up, I just need a break. I just need to get away. I just need to free my mind. And I need to feel good. I need to feel high. I need to feel peace. And a number of other things like that. And I want to tell you this. If you want peace, and a peace that passes all understanding, you won't find it in a bottle. And you won't find it at the end of a cigarette. And you won't find it at a needle when you tie off. Where you will find it is you will find it in Jesus Christ. He's your Savior. He's the Prince of Peace. And He alone can bring you peace in your life. He can make your troubles go away. He can wash your sins where they're clean. He can make your yesterdays go away as if they had never happened. And He can make you clean inside. That's who Jesus is. He's the friend that if you want to be high, then you need to be high on Jesus, if we can use those terms. Well, let's talk for just a moment about the Bible terms. We talked about strongholds. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, another Bible term that tells us the nature of these strongholds Satan sets in our lives, it describes it that Satan, as a roaring lion, goes about seeking whom he may devour. That word devour is a bloody term. Satan is not out to play with us. Satan is out to devour us, to make us bloody, to destroy us. If I were to tell you, listen folks, out here in the parking lot when you go out the door tonight, you may want to look around a little bit. There's a lion loose out there. How many of y'all want to go through that door and step out there? And yet that's the very thing that happens when we get into this addiction world, is there's a roaring lion out there, and he's got you in his sights, and he wants to devour you. And who would be foolish enough to step into an arena like that? So the word stronghold or the word devour is used. When we look at Galatians, the 5th chapter, verse 19 through 21, here we find some addiction terms, among which it talks about drunkenness. And then he talks about the things that accompany that, which we'll get to in a moment. He talks about drunkenness. And then he talks about a thing called sorcery or witchcraft, depending on which translation you have. And that word is a word from the Greek word pharmakia, which is the word we get pharmacy from. And it's a word that means to cast a spell by mixing a potion. I believe that's describing drugs. The nature of the word itself, pharmakia, is where we get the word pharmacy, which is a drugstore, right? And so I believe that is talking about that. If we miss it there, we catch it on the tail end. So we have drunkenness and pharmakia, but then we catch it on the other end when it says, and such like. So whatever the deal is, we've caught it in this basket of the works of the flesh. And Paul very clearly says, those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven. So if we don't want to inherit the kingdom of heaven, then we just play with these things, and that for sure will keep you out. Because he says, these are things that will keep you from heaven. These are things that fight against your relationship to the Lord. And these are things that will destroy you. We're told in 1 Timothy 3, that Satan has snares. Snares are like traps that are set out to entrap you. They're hidden. And you don't always see them until it's too late. And here we're told that we need to stay out of the snare of the devil in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7. And then speaking specifically of alcohol, and speaking specifically of alcohol and mixed drinks in the same context, what we're told is wine is a deceiver. And so we see the nature of the substance, this time alcohol, that it is a deceiver. Those that are caught therein are not wise. Now let's look in this about the things that accompany it. When we talk about people leaving the addictions and going into recovery, what we talk about is three things. If you're going to do this and get out of that lifestyle, you've got to change your playground, your playmates, and your playthings. The paraphernalia and the stuff that you're playing with, you got to get rid of that. All this stuff that's going to trigger, you got to get rid of that. You got to stop the places you're going where you're using this stuff. And you got to stop the friends that you think are your friends that are enticing you to go along with them. And what that means is that when we decide to cut ties with that which is keeping us sick, that which is keeping us addicted, when we cut ties, we've got to stop at least those three areas of our life, and we'll talk about some things to replace that later on. But what accompanies that, these are the friends that go along with the with these works of the flesh. 1 Peter 4 and verse 4 we'll talk about in some detail, and our friends think it's strange that we don't go with them to the same excess of riot, and they speak evil of us. So that tells me that when we don't do what worldly friends want us to do, then they're going to start cutting us out of their invitations. And we may have some times we don't have folks to go out with. We may not have places to go. But rest assured that even though there may be a dry spell in there, you'll find better things to replace that. We're going to talk about how to do that in our church circles later on this weekend. Lasciviousness goes with it. Lasciviousness means that which causes lust or inclines a person toward lust. And a whole bunch of things in that category, but that's one of those works of the flesh, and that goes along with it. The party crowd, promiscuity, lying, cheating, stealing from your friends, all this stuff, dressing hoochie and all that stuff, all that goes with it. And when a person goes into the addiction, they get pulled into this, and things change that are visible about that person. We also see that deception and lying are companions here. Someone said, you know how to tell when an addict's lying? And the old cliche answer is, their lips are moving. I'm not sure that all addicts lie, but I think most of them do. I think some of them, and I know that some of them, will look you square in the face and tell you something that sounds right. Sounds like they're serious this time, but they may mean it, but they're lacking the ability to follow through because the pull of the addiction is stronger than their word. Well, we'll talk more about that, but Revelation 21 verse 8 tells me what the final destiny is to all liars, regardless of what situation they lied under. And then we see how people degrade their bodies. You know, if you're going to be in the addiction circle, you're going to have to pay for that some way. And most folks either steal, or they sell their body, or they hook up with people that are going to furnish their stuff in exchange for them being the mule or going out dealing, carrying for them, whatever. But somehow you're going to have to pay for this. And by the way, the more addicted you get, the higher the price is. I deal with $200 to $400 per day heroin addicts. And they have to get their money somewhere. And it would not be of any surprise if I told you, as I circled one block in the community where I work, that one evening I counted 42 prostitutes that were working the street. And we're not talking about high-dollar prostitutes. We're talking about $5 to $10 an episode prostitutes. That's how low that they have sunk, that they would come to that level, that's all that they would value themselves at. Okay, so we're dealing with some real hardcore stuff. But sin takes you to the bottom. The prodigal learned that in Luke 15. The prodigal son. And he learned that lesson very well. So a person could degrade their own body. Let's go back to 1 Peter 4, 1 through 4. And then I've got some other things I want to say before our break. Peter writes, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourself also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Okay, then now look at this part. So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. Now I want you to look at that. What he says is the time past has been enough time. That's plenty. That's more than enough. And he says that here, for the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desires of the Gentiles. Whatever sinful condition you were in when you came in the Lord's church, that was more than enough. You don't have to go back out there to top off the top of your sin list. When we came into the Lord's kingdom, we made a commitment with Jesus Christ. And here's the commitment. Lord, if you will wash away my sins, if you will take these things out of my life, if you will take that crimson off of my soul and put my name in your book of life, I'll live for you the rest of my life. That's the commitment that we made to Jesus Christ. May God grant that we honor our word on that. That's what it's all about. Well, look what happens to the world. The time past is sufficient. In the past, we pursued a course of sensuality and lust and drunkenness. Look at this. And carousings and drinking parties. Does that sound like clubs? Does that sound like clubbing? Does that sound like someone's got the open bar even in their home or the bar in their home? Sounds like that to me. Drunkenness, carousings and drinkings. Drinking parties and abominable idolatries. I'm going to come back to this in the morning because what we have just described here, drunkenness, carousing, and drinking parties, that's all three levels of alcohol consumption, including social drinking. And we'll talk about that in the morning. Well, in all of this, they think they are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation or riot, and they malign you. And here's what happens. When you take a stand against what your friends are doing, when they're out here drinking, and when they're out here using their drugs, they're out here doing their partying thing, what they're going to think is, you're odd. And guess what? We are compared to them. There's not a thing wrong with that. I'm glad to be odd, if odd is right. And so in this, what we see is that our friends are going to think that it's strange that we don't run wild with them. And they malign you. That means they make fun of you. They're going to ridicule you. Now, didn't Jesus say that I came not to send peace but a sword? And he talked about how we would have enemies. And some of those may be even in our own families. And they'll talk about, here they come to the party. Here comes the Bible thumpers. You know, or here they come. I guess we better put away the alcohol. Here comes all the teetotalers. They'll make fun of you. And fact is, one young lady we baptized, her dad was just so hurt that she'd become a Christian and had given up her habit of PCP and drinking alcohol. And his statement was, my daughter's just not the same daughter anymore. I can't even have fun with her. Her enemy had become her own dad. And he was asking her to, come on, let's have it like it was. Well, that happens. When you take a stand, then you stand for something, but you also stand against something. And that's the nature of that. Well, we're going to talk, all three levels are condemned. Let me get into just a section here. In terms of addiction, and this is important for the rest of this particular series, in terms of addiction, what we see in the clinical arena is some criteria, some signs that a person is addicted. I'm going to run through those very quickly. The first is an increased or a decreased tolerance. And basically what that means is this. Tolerance is the operative word. And it means that what the person started using doesn't give them the same effect that it did the first, second, third time they used it. So guess what? Guess what you're going to do? If you're chasing the high, you want it to feel like you did the first time, and this little bit we're doing whatever we're doing, and that doesn't get it done, guess what's going to happen? We can increase the dosage, and now we're starting to feel like we did the first time. There are several ways we can do that, but increasing, and that's how addiction, chemical addiction, captures us. Inside, what's happening is we're replacing the natural chemicals in our brain, our neurotransmitters. There's a bunch of those. I won't bother you with all the detail of how your brain works, but there are a bunch of neurotransmitters, and all the chemicals that people use are substituting for the normal neurotransmitters. And when that artificial thing is put in, those artificial chemicals will fit the receptor cell that the natural chemical fits. And your body will send out a signal and say, whoa, we got too much going to this receptor cell. And guess what happens? The normal stuff cuts off. and now we're left running on counterfeit. That's what the chemicals do. They run you on counterfeit. And during the period of time when you are shifting, getting sobering up, then there's going to be a period of time that you may not have anything much happening there. And people talk about chasing the highs and avoiding the lows, and they're talking about avoiding that little glitch there. The thing that concerns me more about tolerance than increased tolerance, that bothers me, but the thing that concerns me more is decreased tolerance. And what that means is it takes less to get the same effect. By the time a person is at decreased tolerance, there is some serious stuff physically going on with them. Pancreas, liver, a whole bunch of stuff's going on inside. And what that means is the body's not assimilating the chemical at the same rate it used to. It's not able to take it and to pass it through the system. And therefore, there's damage going on somewhere with some of the organs. That's decreased tolerance. Withdrawal symptoms can go all the way from what people used to talk about is chasing the hair of the dog. Next morning you got a hangover. Maybe you've been kissing the toilet bowl all evening by puking because you drank too much or used too much. Or it may be that we've got real clammy, hands all sweaty. It may be that we're real dull in our thinking. A whole bunch of withdrawal symptoms. But those would tell us that this person is starting to qualify for addiction. The inability to control or quit, which means that when you start, you don't stop. This is the person that goes for happy hour at 5 o'clock and they're only going to have one or two, and 3 o'clock in the morning they're shutting down the bar and needing a ride home. That's the person that when they have one, they can't stop at one. Now let me say this. Most of us aren't that way. As a matter of fact, the population at large, only 80% of the population, 80% of the population can take it or leave it. But 20% are different. And those 20% who are different are basically the ones I'm talking about in terms of addiction. These are the people, by the way, that's 1 in 25, or 1 out of 5. And these are the people that can't stop once they start. These are people that use longer than they intended to. They didn't stop. They don't stop even when there's terrible consequences. They lose their job. They lose their house. One man I was talking to the other day, his wife had challenged him as to when he's going to quit. He went out back with a shotgun and shot twice. She thought he'd blown his head off, but he hadn't. He was just messing with her, trying to make her think that. She didn't think that was funny, and he did. And he came into a treatment center real quick, and she said, "Buddy, I'm done." But that's the foolishness that goes on and surrounds this crazy lifestyles. We talk about the insanity of addiction. Normal people don't act this way. And normal families don't spend their evenings chasing people down that are using and trying to find out if they're okay. Normal families don't do that. We'll talk more about that. Preoccupation means I can't get it out of my mind. And blackouts means that while I'm under the influence, I really didn't know what I did. And the next morning someone says, everybody's looking at you funny, and did I do something funny or wrong last night? And then they'll tell you what you did. Classic on that is if you watch movies, someone goes home with somebody and doesn't know who they're waking up with the next morning. But that would be a classic example of that. Every class of substances that are abused, except for nicotine, have the capacity to mimic mental illness in its different forms. And what I want you to see in that particular slide is that it is difficult to diagnose sometimes, and sometimes people who have an addiction problem will go to see a professional and be misdiagnosed as having a mental health issue, when actually there may be an addiction issue there that is mimicking substance thing. All right. On the outside, we talked about cravings. We talked about psychological changes that take place. But ultimately what happens is the person comes to trust the chemical more than anything else in their life. I hear the guys talk about this all the time. that I could depend on that drug to take me where I wanted to go, to give me the feeling I wanted to feel, and that became my best friend. I use the analogy sometime when I talk to the wives or the families. I just ask the question, if your husband were cheating on you, what would you do? And usually the answer is pretty straight. And it's like, well, guess what? He has been. He's in love with Miss Smirnoff. He's in love with Miss Jack. He's in love with these chemicals. And the pattern of betrayal, putting this, you slept with it, you thought about it all day, you've done, and you go right down the list, and it's a very similar pattern. There's some gender differences. Women tend to get addicted quicker. Part of that is because of body mass and body size. They tend to get addicted quicker, and they tend to seek help much later than men do. Usually it's much more progressed in a female before it is in a male, before they seek treatment. And there are gender differences on that. On the inside, what's happening is there's a change in body chemistry, and we talked about tolerance and withdrawal. Here's one of our key outlines, and this is the one on tolerance. The white line in this outline is a baseline, and what it basically is that's how you feel when you're normal. So here's a person's out here, and they have their first substance experience, and what they do is they catch a buzz, or they get a little high, they get a euphoric feeling, and that first use is probably the best it's going to get. But what happens is, that felt so good that I think I'll try it again. And so we go out again, and then again, and again. But guess what? As you do this two or three times, or several times, I want you to look at the second spike. The second spike's lower. Using the same amount, now we're getting less high, and look at the low. We got lower. And then follow the progression here, and what we see is the far end of that, where the guys tell me, I'm just tired. It's not fun anymore. But I don't want to go through the withdrawal. And so we keep chasing the high to avoid the low. It's no longer fun. Now you've got three choices. You can ride it out. You can increase the dosage, take more of the thing that's giving you that feeling. Or you can start mixing it and adding stronger substances. And that's what usually happens. People start out with our gateway. By the way, the gateway drug is cigarettes. If you can't inhale, you can't smoke a joint either. But tobacco is the gateway drug. And that's used as early as the second and third grades these days. That's not in this series, but there is a lesson on that somewhere. But anyway, so what happens is someone starts using marijuana. And then after a little bit, it's like, well, that didn't quite get it. So we add a little alcohol, and then we add a little cocaine. And by the way, pot alcohol and cocaine go together. If any of you are old enough to remember Pac-Man, you know Pac-Man gobbled up the dots. And that's exactly what addiction will do in your life. Pot alcohol and cocaine will gobble you up, and there won't be anything left of you. So that's what can happen there. I want to end this with this particular set of slides. These are what's called SPEC scans. And these are pictures of your brain. And I want to show you what is happening on the inside. We talked about the neurotransmitters changing. Well, this one here would show us from several views of a normal brain. Of significance here is the color and that there are relatively no dark spots in that. That's what a healthy brain looks like when it's functioning normally. Okay. Now, person has a stroke. By the way, these are not holes in the brain. They're just areas of the brain that stopped working. But look how the color's changed. And now we start seeing that there are gaps in there to where the brain's got to find new pathways in order to function. This is an Alzheimer patient. Here's someone who had a head injury. And here's the real reason not to do drugs. They damage your brain, and in doing so, they damage your access to yourself and to your rational person, and they limit you in what you're able to do, period. That's the real reason. Here's what a cocaine brain looks like, and a methamphetamine. Y'all know what methamphetamine is? You got that around here? Ice crank, meth. Okay. By the way, a meth head, persons on meth, is a person that when they come off of that, it's a synthetic drug that mimics cocaine, but is much stronger than any of the other synthetics out there, at least as of today. And what methamphetamine does, when it goes through those receptor cells in your brain, it is usually mixed so with so much potency that it cauterizes, like burns, the receptor cell, both at the sending and the receiving sites. And here's what that means in practical terms. When a person makes a decision, a long-term meth user decides to get off meth, their option is when they get off, is either to be depressed for 6 months to 2 years, or to continue using. Because a lot of the chemicals that we have that we would treat that with don't work because there's damage. Here, I saw a man. Everybody told me this man was a really nice guy, and that he was friendly and he was funny. And I didn't see that. He was flat as a pancake around me. And about 9 months later, John started waking up, and he was funny as a hoot. He was everything folks said he was. But when I saw him, this is what was going on in his brain. And for him, it lasted 9 months as he was coming off his meth. This is what alcohol does. By the way, alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. And what that means is it will put the front part of your brain to sleep. Now, the front part of your brain is your center of conscience. It's your regulator that tells you what's right and what's wrong. That's why when we put this to sleep, people say the dumbest things, the craziest things. People will come on to somebody that they wouldn't normally do that because they would be inhibited, but that takes the inhibition away. These are the ones that if they're angry and suppressing anger, they're the ones that want to have the fights and they kind of get into it with somebody. Why? Because these parts of the brain have been shut down. The heroin addict, notice how the colors have changed again. Someone says, well, you know, they ought to just legalize marijuana because it doesn't do anything to you. Well, I would beg to differ with you. The young man that said that, we took a picture of his brain. And I asked him, I said, let me show you a couple of pictures of brains. This is a normal brain. This is a marijuana brain. Which one do you want? He wanted the normal. And I said, well, guess what? That other one's yours. This man epitomizes for us what substances can do for you. These are mug shots, by the way. These are okay to show. This man, the first time he was arrested for methamphetamine, that was his mugshot. 5 years later, his picture tells the story. Here's a lady, 3 years and 5 months. What I tell the young ladies that gets them more than anything else and makes them decide that they don't want to use drugs anymore is if you use drugs, it will age you quicker and you'll be ugly. And I show them these pictures, and it's like, well, I don't want to do that. So they go into recovery. Whatever it takes, that's what it takes. You don't want to be ugly. Here's a lady, a year and 5 months. Fairly attractive woman to start with. That's the hard life. And here's what I want you to see. Is that those very same people are the ones that are caught in the gospel dragnet. These are the people that have hit bottom and are looking for something better. They come to us from the bars and the streets. They come to us from the back corners. And they come saying there has to be something better. And these are the people that we need to be here to help climb back out of this pock, this slimy hole that they're in, and to climb back to productive citizens. And can it happen? You bet it can. And I can tell you more stories about how that happens. Well, here's what I'm going to end with. And that is, addiction is a false pathway to spirituality, and that the Bible is the answer to all of life's problems. 2 Peter 1 and verse 3, that seeing that His divine grace has granted unto us all things all things that pertain to life. That's how to live here and get along on this earth. Pertain to life and to godliness. As Christians, we are to avoid the very appearance of evil. That means if it's anywhere near something that looks like it's Satan's, stay away from it. You have no business being there. And we are to give no occasion to the adversary to speak evil of us. We need to go out of our way to do what's right and to have our name as God's child associated with what is right, not with that which is questionable and not with that which is clearly wrong.